Hello, and welcome to the Governance Matters podcast from Governance Intelligence, formerly known as Corporate Secretary. In this show, we examine the work of governance professionals and the latest developments they face. I'm your host, Editor-at-Large Ben Maiden. In recent years, US companies have faced increased pressure from investors and other stakeholders, such as employees, to improve diversity, equity, and inclusion within their organizations. Supporters of taking such action point not just to its importance from a moral or ethical standpoint, but also to the benefits to companies in terms of operational and ultimately financial success. Of course, there has also been pushback from some lawmakers and conservative groups who argue that trying to increase diversity is a distraction from a company's core mission, and that even it is somehow creating an unfair playing field. That argument gained legal traction last summer when the US Supreme Court ruled against affirmative action-based missions at universities. Although the decision didn't address corporate diversity programs as such, a group of Republican state attorneys general warned large companies that the ruling means some workforce diversity policies could be illegal. It's also been reported that several major companies have modified or dropped DEI policies after conservative groups threatened to sue. In this episode, I'm joined by three guests to discuss these important issues and what they mean for companies, their boards, and governance. First, Meredith Benton, principal and founder of consultancy Whistlestop Capital, talks about a report produced by shareholder advocacy group As You Sow called Capturing the Diversity Benefit. Benton, who is lead author of the report, explains some of the key findings and the governance lessons they present. Luke Morgan, attorney with As You Sow, discusses the legal environment of potential liabilities facing companies and their DEI programs, as well as how to limit those exposures. And Andrew Bihar, CEO of As You Sow, talks about the importance of diversity disclosures, the dangers of dropping DEI programs, and investor expectations in the current environment. I began by asking Meredith Benton about what prompted the research into diversity right now. Well, thank you all for being here today. Meredith, if we could start with you, please, as you were most heavily involved in the research. And as you know, and as you point out, there's been quite a lot of research around, both academic and otherwise, about the benefits of diversity for companies. So what prompted you to do this research sort of separately from that?
So this research is actually the second year of it, but coming into the 2023 data, we were extraordinarily excited because there was a reporter who did a FOIA request, a Freedom of Information Act request, that brought out a huge number of EEO-1 reports that we didn't have access to. EEO-1 reports are government-required detailing of workforce diversity. So we went from having under 400 companies that were voluntarily sharing this data to having more than 1,600 companies, public companies, where we could look at their workforce diversity and really begin to pull some attribution to financial performance. We were absolutely psyched to have this level of data to look into.
And so when you go about sort of comparing those reports, what sort of data points were you looking for, and how did you go about trying to sort of compare across companies?
Yeah, so we took the collection of data that we had. So between 2016 and 2021, so we had 5 years worth of data. We had over 1,600 companies. We did an ordinary least squares regression against a wide range of financial performance metrics, looking to see in what ways corporate diversity and manager diversity might link up to financial performance. And what we found was there was a significant, positive, statistically significant correlation between more manager diversity and financial performance across a number of indicators.
Mm-hmm. How, in terms of, you talk about management there, what levels of seniority do the EEO-1 data cover?
So the EEO-1 data is imperfect. It is the best data set we have access to. And one of the things that we are consistently doing is calling for more data that allows us to look at this content with greater granularity and more nuance. But within the EEO-1 data, we are able to split out total workforce diversity from the executive and senior officials and the first and mid-level officials and managers. So what we did is we looked at those individuals who had been clearly categorized by their companies as within a managerial role relative to total workforce.
Mm-hmm. Did it just instantly, I don't know if you broke it down like this, did the benefits vary much by year? I mean, obviously, during that five-year period, we've had some ups and downs, shall we say. I mean, was there any indication that in time, difficult times, maybe there's more benefit to it or not, or maybe that's just not a factor?
Yeah, so we had 5 years of data, 2016 to 2021. And the year where we see a very significant shift is 2020. In 2020, we see a significant increase in both total workforce diversity and diverse hiring, and then the percentage of individuals within managerial or leadership roles. In 2020 to 2021, we're seeing that increase. We don't yet have the data set because it's a lagging data set that indicates the financial shift associated with that point in time. We're backwards looking in terms of the data we have access to.
And were there marked differences between industries? And any thoughts on why that may be?
Yeah, there were very significant differences between industries. So overall, across, and when we aggregated all the data, we saw a statistically significant positive association with enterprise value growth rate, income after tax, 10-year compound annual growth rate for revenue, for return on equity, return on invested capital, for price change, for the stock price change over 10 years, as well as long-term growth expectations and free cash flow per share. That's in aggregate. But within sectors, we didn't always see that positive correlation. So there were, within communication services, consumer discretionary, consumer staples, financials, healthcare, and IT, it was only positive correlations. We saw nothing that was statistically significant that was negative within financial performance. There were three sectors, however, energy, materials, and real estate, where it was negative. We saw a negative correlation between manager diversity and financial performance. And we absolutely wanted to understand why that was happening.
And any thoughts? I mean, that seems, that's very surprising.
Right. Because there are so many reasons that diversity is additive. It was unusual and surprising to find it wasn't happening within these three sectors. So we dug a lot deeper on that. And coming into this year's research, we're planning to go even further on this part of the question. But fortunately, As You Sow has something called the Racial Justice Initiative. And the Racial Justice Initiative has looked at corporate understanding and action as it relates to race and equity issues. And they had already scored the companies that we were looking at, or a subset of the companies we were looking at, across those companies' understanding of race issues. And when we looked at how those sectors scored around their broader understanding of race, so looking beyond their employees, inclusive of, but looking beyond their employees, we saw that the same sectors that were not able to earn a benefit from their diverse staff were the same sectors that do not understand, or there's a strong indication that they don't understand race and equity issues more broadly. So they are missing out. Their lack of preparedness around race and equity, the lack of CEO engagement, there's across these 27 indicators, shows that they are underperforming because of it.
Can I just jump in here?
Sure. This is Andy Behar for our audience. Yes, Andy, please go ahead.
Thanks. So with the As You Sow Racial Justice Scorecard, which looks at 3,000 companies on 27 key performance indicators, it really teases out culture. And what we found is that the culture around diversity, the culture around racial justice, in these sectors where they weren't getting the diversity benefit, where they weren't getting this financial benefit, that was very low. That you not only need headcount, but you also need a culture, which means elevating people, of different races and ethnicities and gender to higher levels, as well as seeing that executive management was actually caring about this issue.
Okay, thank you. And Meredith, I mean, just boards weren't included in this study. Obviously, EEO-1 data does not look at boards, but do you have any indication? I mean, there have been studies showing that board diversity does correlate with improved performance. Is there any data that you'd point to that sort of underlines that or supports that view?
So there are separate research and studies that go beyond what we've done that look at that. We're also increasingly paying attention to how well the board is providing oversight of its human resource management of diversity. We are seeing more and more companies that are reporting on what we call the inclusion factors, the hiring, promotion, and retention rates of their staff. And our expectation at this point in time, given this data set, is that the board would be actively monitoring a dashboard of those statistics at their meetings, because this pipeline of talent is so important to have, and there's so much complexity in doing the work well.
Mm-hmm. And what do you sort of see is the role of the board in building on that? What is the role of the board in terms of promoting diversity within the company? Obviously, they're not as management doing the hires, but what do you see is the board's role?
There's two key components. One is that the board itself should speak to the importance of diversity and have that communication be public, not just to current employees, but to potential and future employees, so that they are aware that this will be a good company for them to fit into. And the other is that oversight mechanism, which is such a core focus of a board's responsibility, is to have them ensuring that they understand what's happening within their company and within their sector. It's unique for each company, and that they are looking at whether or not there's a positive progression over time. There certainly shouldn't be expected to have a perfect program, but for them to understand what's happening. It's a very nuanced and complex thing, race in America.
Certainly is. Meredith, thank you. Moving on to the legal aspect of this, Luke Morgan, again, thanks for being here. Now, as you know, and as many of our listeners will have seen, some companies have been concerned about potential legal challenges to their DEI programs following on from the Supreme Court ruling about affirmative action. On what basis could conceivably a case be brought, or is there, in your view, a kind of sound base, legal basis on to bring a lawsuit against a company that challenges its DEI program?
Yeah, thanks, Ben. So as you said, this all kind of comes back to these two Supreme Court decisions last year relating to affirmative actions in universities. One of those decisions involved Harvard, which is a private school. And so the reason that the Supreme Court held that racial discrimination, or that the affirmative action programs constituted racial discrimination, which was illegal at Harvard, is a law called Title VI, which prohibits discrimination by programs receiving federal funding, such as universities. Now, what this really comes down to is, in that decision, Justice Gorsuch wrote a concurring opinion, which pointed out that the language prohibiting racial discrimination in Title VI was actually identical to the language prohibiting discrimination in Title VII. And therefore, Justice Gorsuch implied that probably the same decision would be true in the context of Title VII, which is, of course, about discrimination in employment. And so he was sending a signal, and I think that certain groups have like picked up on that signal and are running with it. So Title VII is one context. The second context is Section 1981, which is a Reconstruction era statute prohibiting race discrimination in contracts, which obviously applies to employment contracts as well. And so because Title VII has certain procedural requirements, you have to go through a state EEO office or a federal EEO office before you can file a lawsuit. Some litigants are skipping that and going straight to Section 1981. And I think that, you know, whether you think that it is a good legal basis to have these kind of Reconstruction era and civil rights era statutes being used to strike down diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts is one question, but that's the legal basis that litigants are using to challenge these programs.
So cases are being brought, and obviously their chance of success obviously depends on the forum where they bring them and the specific facts of the case, obviously. But mm-hmm. I mean, do you have any sense of excluding outliers, should we say, of certain courts? Is this a reasonable basis? Is this of having success?
Yeah, I mean,
how worried should companies be? I guess is what I'm trying to say in a roundabout.
Yeah, I do. I mean, again, setting aside, I think, kind of the objective legal merits of the question, I do think that it's a legitimate concern. And you said setting aside outlier courts, the reality is that kind of the whole court system is moving in one direction. So there's fewer and fewer what I would call outlier courts. So in terms of likelihood of success, I think you saw a direct kind of decision on that question, which was in this 11th Circuit case. There was it was a fund intended to promote entrepreneurship by Black women. It was challenged under Section 1981. The district court held that it was not illegal, and the 11th Circuit reversed. The litigation is still ongoing, but the 11th Circuit's holding directly was that the challengers of that program were likely to succeed in their argument that that program violated Section 1981. I think that one other example I would point to is you have three lawsuits brought against law firms alleging that their diversity fellowships violated Section 1981. And in response to that, two of those law firms changed their diversity fellowships. And the third firm, the litigation is ongoing. So I think that you're seeing corporations acting as if there is kind of a real threat here. And so, yeah, that's worth keeping in mind.
So is there any way, and again, you know, as a lawyer, I'm sure you'll refer me to facts and circumstances, but is there potentially any way that companies can limit their potential exposure, I should say, to these types of lawsuits while continuing with their DEI efforts? Is it a question of maybe keeping those not so public or changing the way they're constituted or framed? How can you sort of limit your exposure while continuing to do with these efforts?
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, like you said, it's going to depend on the facts, and companies should talk to their general counsels and not go off of what I'm saying. But, you know, companies should be clear that they're maintaining their DEI programs or strengthening, ideally, their DEI programs. Because as Meredith points out, diversity, equity, and inclusion are business benefits. They help companies, and companies, you know, have an obligation to maximize the risk-adjusted value for their shareholders, and DEI programs help them do that. I think that one other thing to keep in mind is that companies can still kind of prioritize the achievement of diverse teams through a holistic review of candidates' experiences. Just last week, the Supreme Court declined to overturn a Fourth Circuit decision involving a public high school, where the Fourth Circuit held that improving racial diversity and inclusion by way of race-neutral measures was fine. And it was really unclear that if that kind of reasoning was going to survive last year's Supreme Court cases, and it would have been really easy for the court to tell the Fourth Circuit to take another shot at this, but they didn't. So I think if you collate all the guidance that we're getting from the courts, one kind of big guidance you get is don't do quotas. And I think that's probably consistent with how companies have been approaching these questions already. But the big underlying point is that, you know, this is a business benefit, and you can achieve diversity through carefully crafted programs without violating the law.
And I guess the flip side of that is what are the potential legal risks for companies and including for boards, as I'm sure our audience will be very conscious of not continuing with their DEI efforts? Would that, the argument be the flip side of what you're saying is someone might come along and a shareholder might come along and say, hey, you dropped all these diversity efforts, that's potentially harming the business?
Yeah, I think.
Is that a risk?
You nailed it on the head right there. With the wealth of data indicating that if companies aren't maintaining their DEI programs, then they're not maximizing returns for shareholders. They're not serving their shareholders well if they're going to kind of duck and hide from these potential, you know, bad faith legal challenges. I also think that there's a reality where if you have kind of homogeny in companies that can kind of ingrain itself, and it can lead to practices and ways of talking that may appear kind of facially neutral until you have a court looking at them in the context of a racial discrimination claim, and things start to look a little bit more suspect. So I think that that's worth keeping in mind as well, that, you know, having a strong DEI program and having strong diversity in your company can be an inoculation against those kinds of concerns.
Okay, Luke, thank you so much. So Andy, just we're having this discussion in the context, as you know, of political and these legal pushbacks, as Luke was just explaining, against diversity efforts. Is your sense from either engagement or other avenues that boards in particular continue to understand the value of diversity? Obviously, there was a large push in 2020, but in the sort of the slightly changed environment, are boards still aware of the value of diversity, as your research indicates?
You know, in 2018, we started this effort by sending a letter to 3,000 companies saying that diversity, equity, and inclusion are material issues. It was signed by, I think, about $2 to $3 trillion worth of assets under management that all agreed that this is a material issue, that this is information that shareholders need in order to make a buy or a sell decision. And so once we did that, we sent that out, and then we started to engage literally hundreds of companies. Some of them escalated to filing resolutions saying, we need greater data. We need to see recruitment, retention, and promotion data that's parsed by all of the protected classes. We need actual, much more granular data than we were even seeing in the EEO-1s. The project to look at the data as a larger set, as Meredith mentioned, really was helped by the fact this FOIA, this Freedom of Information Act letter, that allowed us to the Department of Labor to provide us with these EEO-1s across 5 years and across all of these companies. So the data is absolutely clear. This is a material issue. Therefore, companies should be disclosing it, and investors should be including it in their decision making. That's the bottom line. The companies who are feeling threatened, who have been dropping their DEI departments, I believe that they're actually, you know, in breach of their fiduciary duty because they are not profit maximizing and they're not explaining to shareholders why they're making these changes that could affect all the financial metrics. And, you know, there's, you know, Zoom dropped their DEI team, Snap, Meta, Tesla, DoorDash, Lyft, Home Depot, a whole bunch of these companies have come out publicly and saying, we're slashing our DEI teams. And I think that that's an indication that those companies should probably be underweighted or really questioned why they're doing this, why they're not operating to maximize profits.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned disclosure, and obviously it was it took a long time and quite a lot of pressure to get companies to start to release the EEO-1 data, as you know, and then there was a sudden flood of that, I guess 2 or 3 years ago now. And companies have generally in their proxy statements and in ESG reports have been disclosing more information around this. As from your position, what would you like to see in terms of disclosure from companies? What should boards and their, obviously their corporate secretaries, governance teams be looking to include? What's the kind of state of the art now, I guess, in a sense, now that EEO-1 is pretty standard baseline disclosures?
Well, EEO-1 is still not standard. This means we're getting this through Freedom of Information Act from the Department of Labor. Not every company is disclosing it to their actual shareholders. So EEO-1 is the baseline. That is absolutely just the floor. But what we're looking for is recruitment, retention, and promotion data that's then parsed by the protected classes. Meredith, you want to just go into a little more detail? Meredith is actually the person who is engaging, like talking to each of the companies one at a time to explain and getting them to understand why we need this level of disclosure.
Mm-hmm. And with investors, similarly, there's been talk over the last year or so about some asset managers dropping the term ESG in favor of something way more convoluted and related to materiality. Are you seeing less interest from investors in pushing for diversity at companies?
Absolutely not. I think investors are actually looking for more information. Whatever you want to call it, you can call it. The bottom line is that what we want to see is, well, we want to assess and address risk. We want to assess and address environmental risk. That means in the supply chain, raw commodities, all of the environmental risks, and certainly climate change is having a big impact on that because, well, for instance, you should know if there's a massive flood in Bangladesh and a massive drought in Texas that are going to cut the amount of cotton on the global markets. If you're an apparel maker, you should know about the olive oil. There's not going to be any olive oil coming out of Spain and Southern Europe because of a massive heat wave. Cacao just hit its highest prices in history. You should know that if you're a chocolate manufacturer. If you are not doing that, then you're not doing your job. So that's environmental. On social side, we want to assess and address risk having to do with the workforce. So you should know about your culture and about hiring and also about the greater diversity you have in your, you know, culturally among your employees, the better you're going to be able to serve markets. And we want to assess and address governance risk also. So, I mean, ESG is just a framework for assessing risk. Any business person that's not assessing and addressing risk is not doing their job. Any investor who's not assessing and addressing risk is potentially in breach of their fiduciary duty because that's their job.
Mm-hmm. And just any other final takeaways for governance teams from your research, Andy or Merritt or both? Any just quick takeaways that they should draw from that?
Sure. The most important thing that the research at this stage has shown us is that we have enough data to say at a high level, diversity is very clearly positively correlated with outperformance at the management level. That's the challenge in creating an attribution analysis for stock performance is quite significant. And so that we were able to see such a strong link between management diversity and performance was really striking in our findings. And you better believe we checked it more than twice. We still don't have enough data to provide more of the types of insights that would be helpful to a corporate board. So which programs, diversity programs, are most effective? Which components of the diversity programs need to have greater oversight or greater funding? How do you want to structure these programs? All of that relies on corporate release of data and the ability to look at that data and compare one company to the next. And we're moving towards that phase, but we are not moving quickly enough. So the call is to ensure that their company is sharing their hiring, promotion, and retention rates along with their workforce diversity statistics so that their company can be well understood by an external audience. And so that we can also start to move into this next stage, which is how to do this well. We know it matters. Now let's look into how to do it well.
Okay. Well, Meredith Benton, Luke Morgan, Andy Bahar, thank you so much for being with us today and sharing your thoughts and data.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you, Ben.
Governance Intelligence invites you to read its latest governance playbook, How to Prepare Your Board for the Road Ahead, sponsored by SAI 360. This comprehensive report delves into the crucial role of director education and training in board governance. Drawing from insights from governance professionals and experienced board members, it provides actionable steps and best practices for corporate secretaries to enhance their training programs. Discover how to craft agendas that cover both timeless and emerging topics, essential for directors. Learn how to determine the most effective delivery methods. Ensure the board remains well-equipped with the right tools to fulfill its duties and drive the company's success. To access the report today for free, head over to the research tab at governance-intelligence.com.
You've been listening to the latest episode of the Governance Matters podcast, brought to you by Governance Intelligence. If you enjoyed the show, please make sure to like, subscribe, and leave a review on Spotify, Google, and Apple Podcasts, Acast, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Many thanks to Noemi DiStefano at the controls, and until next time, thanks for listening.